All
Good
right.
idea. All right. So what do you want to tell me about quantum metaphysics?
Well, I'm going to ask you a lot of questions. This is an interesting chapter. You provided this to me from a book. What was it? Quantum Mechanics and the Particles of Nature.
Yes.
And this chapter is called Quantum Metaphysics, which I think is a great name.
Well, is that the chapter? Yeah. Oh, that is the chapter, right? Mm-hmm. And the section is Interpretations of Quantum Mechanics. But this is the same chapter where he talks about Bell's theorem and he talks about quantum logic. He talks about all sorts of things that people don't get into too much usually at a undergraduate level. I mean, this is a very old book, and people apparently didn't like it. I liked it when I got it. So, I mean, I picked it up when I was an undergraduate because, well, we had a really great college bookstore, which other places don't have. Like any other place I've ever been to, I was surprised. But, you know, we had this really great bookstore that had that had all sorts of technical books all the time. They were just out there, and you know, I'd browse through and I'd pick things up that looked interesting, and I'm pretty sure this was one of the things that looked interesting in that.
I love this book. I think it's beautifully formatted and it's well written.
Well, it's written by a mathematician, an English mathematician, and if you read it, it has a lot of those properties. But a lot of the things that I understood about quantum mechanics, I actually got from this book at some point, and I didn't really realize it until I looked at it. You know, they have all sorts of things like discussions about the different forces of nature and things along those lines. So some of these things I actually thought I'd gotten from a National Geographic or Scientific American book, but they actually came from here. I mean, it's actually very nice. It's a nice way to go through things. So sometimes when you look at a quantum mechanics book, it starts off with a historical treatment that doesn't really help you very much. Sometimes it just jumps right into the Schrodinger equation. The best ones that I've found have actually used the Stern-Gerlach experiment as the first thing they talk about. But this guy starts off talking about particle physics, and then he works his way into quantum mechanics through the particle physics.
Remind me again, what's the Stern-Gerlach experiment? We've looked at a lot of the experiments lately.
Okay, well, the Stern-Gerlach experiment is one that's going to be really important later on when we're going through the rest of the Quantum Paradoxes book.
Right.
That's going to be really important. It's one of the two sorts of things where we have this really nice experiment with a two-state system, right? Mm-hmm. So the Stern-Gerlach experiment takes electrons which have a spin, and it orients the electrons in a gradient magnetic field. Mm-hmm. Then you'll block off your beam that has the wrong spin, right? So you send your beam through here. If it's completely random, it'll split into two chunks, one with the spin aligned with the magnetic field, one anti-aligned, going the opposite direction. And then those will split off because of the forces will be exactly opposite on those two.
Mm-hmm.
As when those split off, you can break off one beam, and the other beam will keep on going, and then you can put a second gradient field on there in a different orientation, or the same orientation, but a different orientation, and measure what percentage of the particles have the same spin.
Mm-hmm.
And this is very useful for showing things like the fact, well, this is very useful for showing, this is very useful for showing things like the fact that when you're adding up these probabilities,
mm-hmm.
they're adding like they have an intensity. They're an intensity rather than a direct measure of the wave function, right? So that you're doing cosines and sines and things like that, rather than just a direct proportion. if that makes any sense. There's sort of a vector character to all this. So, I guess you don't need the vector character, but you can use these in this two-state system to go through a lot of the properties of quantum measurement without getting into the details of the Schrödinger equation and other complicated, messy things, so that when you get to the Schrödinger equation, you're already prepared with most of the probability things, and you're prepared with most of the probability, most of the ideas of the wave function, the idea that you have these amplitudes that you have to square to get the intensity, and that intensity is the probability, and so forth.
Oh, I see. So it's a good experiment for demonstrating the mathematics of quantum mechanics.
Yes. Yeah. It's very good for that. And in fact, when Bohm introduced the mathematical formulation of the EPR paradox, he did it using that Stern-Gerlach experiment. So the EPR paradox was originally, I shouldn't say loosey-goosey, but I'm going to say it was originally loosey-goosey. It was well-constructed logically, but it wasn't well-formulated mathematically with some sort of experiment. Bohm used the Stern-Gerlach experiment to do that. And then Bell followed with that, and then I think Aspect decided to use polarized light instead.
Yeah.
Because the polarized light is the other experiment where you have this very nice two-state system that displays quantum mechanical interactions.
Okay.
So, anyways, that was the Stern-Gerlach experiment.
That's actually a nice lead-in, because one of the first things we're going to get into I think it was Bohr's model, Bohr's interpretation of quantum mechanics, which talks a lot about the, I guess it's the minimal interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Did you think the preamble here was of any use at all, or did you think it was just a bunch of BS?
Well, he doesn't really use a lot of these terms in there. He starts the chapter, and this is Anthony Sudbury, the author. He starts out by going over some of the basic philosophy of science, and he talks about empiricism, and positivism, and operationalism, and pragmatism. Those are interesting. He doesn't get into a lot of those, though, in the discussion about the interpretations of quantum mechanics.
Yeah, I didn't think that there was much there. I mean, a couple of places he talks about things that sound like it has an instrumentalist stance.
Yeah.
But he doesn't really use these in his discussion.
Right.
And then he goes into the peculiarities of quantum mechanics. And he has four of those, right?
Mm-hmm. He goes over those a lot, though, so we should cover those.
Well, he does go over those a lot. And when I was reading those, I thought he was going to use all four of those to look at each one of the nine interpretations.
Right.
But he doesn't really go into any of those in much detail, so it doesn't really end up that way. But I was thinking, but I mean, this is the thing, you only have so much time, right? I was thinking about trying to put together some sort of table and trying to fill it out with the nine interpretations and the four peculiarities and what each one said about each.
Yeah, that would be great.
But I didn't, and I'm not going to.
Well, they do come up in some key points, though, in these nine interpretations that he's picked out. I guess these are the nine interpretations that are most prevalent within the field of the mechanical community?
I don't think anyone is a single interpretation. You can tell from some of them that he's talking about multiple interpretations.
Right.
But I think there are more categories of different interpretations. Mm-hmm. And you see a lot of these things show up. Like the many worlds interpretation, I somewhere saw somebody made his own brand new many worlds interpretation. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. Recently in the American Journal of Physics, there was somebody talking about quantum Bayesianism, so that would be another subjective interpretation of quantum mechanics. So, these categories are good because even though people are working on new interpretations, they still fall into these categories.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's probably good to look through them and try to figure out what each one of those is. Although, again, each one of these new interpretations, which I'm saying falls into this or that category, it also has its own eccentricities. Otherwise, these people wouldn't say it's a new interpretation, right?
Right. One thing that an interpretation that's been kind of rattling around in my brain is we've talked a little bit in the past. I mentioned Isaac Barr's work on the two-time universe, and it seems like there may be a direct relationship to quantum mechanics. And I was thinking maybe we should get him on the air sometime and see if we can ask him about that, because a second time dimension may, according to the writings that. The parts of it I could understand in his really heavy theoretical papers is that an extra dimension of time would give you the same observational results that we get from quantum mechanics, where when you get down to extremely high precision on something like position, then momentum suddenly becomes infinitely uncertain, because as you get closer to that point in time, it's the effect of the additional dimension of time operating perpendicularly gives you a range of probability. It can be any of these values. So I'd love to hear what he has to say about that. Maybe he can elucidate on that a little bit, because that may be a tenth interpretation. With it, as far as I can tell, doesn't really fall into any of these interpretations.
Oh, I wouldn't know. I'm not sure. I think you. I think it probably would fall into some sort of hidden variable interpretation.
Maybe you're right, because the hidden variable would be the extra dimension of time.
Yeah, so I think that's probably where it would end up, but I have no idea. Again, these are broad categories, right? And all the hidden variable, well, I guess it's a jump, but the hidden variable interpretation just says that there's something else that we're not taking account of that's giving us these quantum mechanical effects. And what makes it an interpretation is that the way you set up the theory, you can't figure out in principle any differences between what you've set up and what you measure in the real world, right? You can't tell any difference between this and regular quantum mechanics with an interpretation that does not include it.
Right, otherwise it'd be a new theory altogether.
That's right.
Well, all right.
Okay, yeah, well, we probably ought to get going with something I've actually read about.
Well, first let's start with the peculiarities of quantum mechanics, because those are the fun goddams sort of that make quantum mechanics so fascinating and unique.
Okay, so tell me about indeterminism.
I believe that indeterminism talks about is the concept that some information about a system is fundamentally unknowable, and so it's not just unknown like the state of any particular atom in a gas in a thermal system, but it's fundamentally unknowable, and so what comes in philosophically that's fascinating is that if it's fundamentally unknowable, then there are effects in nature which can't be ascribed to cause.
Yeah, so what I have written down is quantum mechanics quantum mechanics is formulated so it seems like some events are uncaused, some effects have no cause.
Right.
Which is not something we want to hear about. So the question I think that people should have when they're looking at these interpretations, when they're listening to these interpretations, is that what you want to do is you want to ask yourself, does it elucidate probability in general,
right,
or does it elucidate quantum mechanics in particular? Which of those happens?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we're going to find out that what we're talking about is really an interpretation of probability rather than an interpretation of quantum mechanics.
Mm-hmm. Well, I believe there's a couple of ways of looking at it where the state vector, which is kind of the unknowable, like global system that you can get any result out of, may be philosophically the same as a probability function, right? An operator.
Well, it's
There's a couple interpretations where the probability is an intrinsic aspect of the system. And so you don't even need to distinguish mathematically because they act the same way.
Yeah, well, I think in quantum mechanics, the state vector is a kind of probability generator. That's the way mathematically it works.
Right. I've seen the operator like used differently. Like you can use either this p probability term, or you can use the state vector.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to use the state vector, and you only pull out the probability when you want to compare something to an experiment, or when you want to make a prediction, you have to pull out the probability, but you don't care about that probability up until the point where you're making a prediction.
Okay. How do you pull out the probability? Is that part of the Brockett notation?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's just the square of, it's a square. But it has a particular way of doing things. So basically what you're going to do is you're going to look at a transition from one state to another, mm-hmm. right? And that could be, you know, going from having a spin up to a spin down, having a spin in the plus Z direction to the plus X direction, something like that. It could be, the transition could be there's an electron over at this detector on the left-hand side of the room, and now there's an electron on the detector on the right-hand side of the room, right? Mm-hmm. That's still a transition. There's a transition between two states. And even though, you know, we think of one of these things as a path to get from one place to another, and that's the same electron, right? Mm-hmm. In quantum mechanics, the way it's formulated, that's not the way it works. You just say, okay, I've set up my system. Here's my probability for having something occur over here if I already know that something's happened over there. So quantum mechanics is agnostic about why that is.
It doesn't say anything about what's happening in between. It just talks about the measurements themselves, right?
That's right.
And where it gets really boggling is the state vector gets restored to a random condition after each measurement, right? So that the next measurement doesn't reflect what happened in the last measurement. Is that right?
Well, I don't think it goes to a completely random condition, but certain aspects can all of a sudden seem randomized, right? So if you measure if you measure the magnetic moment of an electron with the Stern-Gerlach experiment in the Z direction, it'll have the beam coming out will have the two beams coming out will have definite Z will have definite Z spins. One will be spin up, one will be spin down.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Then if you were to do another experiment on the z-axis, right, you take that z-up beam, and then you do another z-up experiment.
Yeah.
Everything's going to be z-up.
Okay.
Everything's going to be aligned with that same field. Now, if you do a z-down experiment, if you turn that magnetic field 180 degrees around,
right,
you'll get nothing coming out of it. Still, it has that definite spin state in the Z direction.
Okay.
But now if you do something like turn the Stern-Gerlach experiment 90 degrees instead of 180 degrees, so it's in, say, the X direction.
Okay.
Send the beam through that, you'll get 50-50 each way, right? You measured Z to be up in one direction. You haven't said anything about what happens in the X direction.
Right.
Makes sense so far.
Sure, right? You haven't filtered anything out.
That's right. So now you decide, okay, well, I'm going to take one of those two beams, mm-hmm. right? And I'm going to run it through the Stern-Gerlach experiment again in the Z direction.
So you've already done a Z direction preparation.
Yeah.
And then you've done an X direction measurement.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to take one of those directions, say a positive X mm-hmm. spin, and you're going to put it through another Z. Okay.
Yeah. So I filtered out all the minus Zs. Then mm-hmm. I filtered out all the minus Xs. And then I do another plus Z experiment.
Right.
And then it's going to be 50-50 Z up and Z down.
Wow. Okay. So it's almost as if by measuring the X direction suddenly the Z has become scrambled again.
Yep.
Okay. That's pretty bewildering.
Yeah, and that's what quantum mechanics say.
Is that where we get into indeterminacy, or is that indeterminism? No, I guess that's maybe a little bit of both. The indeterminate state is the one that really messes my head up.
Yeah, the indeterminacy, I think there's a little bit of that in there. So the indeterminism and indeterminacy, right? The second one is indeterminacy.
Right.
The second peculiarity. They're related, but they're not quite the same. Right.
Okay.
It's not just because they have similar names that you're confused. They are related. Right?
Okay.
But in this case, the idea is that the particle need not have a definite position and momentum at the same time, for example.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it cannot have a definite position and momentum at the same time.
Right.
And this is actually the same thing with this experiment in the this is the same thing with the Stern-Gerlach experiment. The X component of the spin and the Z component of the spin are related in exactly the same way, or are related in mathematically the same way as the position and the momentum. There's an uncertainty principle between them, and you can't know both of them to better than H bar.
Okay.
So therefore, after you've prepared a state in the Z direction, you no longer know anything about the X direction. Once you've prepared it in the X direction, you no longer know anything about the Z direction.
That's interesting. So one of the things that it said in there was the indeterminate state of an observable quantity, I guess like position or momentum, when it's not in an eigenstate of it. So if it's not prepared, is that what they're saying? That if it's not prepared, like the Stern-Gerlach experiment where you give it an eigenstate or you pre-select for that eigenstate, if you haven't prepared it that way, if you leave it wide open, then it's not in any given state, rather than saying...
Yeah, so we've got this issue where it's possible to not be in an eigenstate, in a known energy state of the system, right? Where you could be in either of two energy states.
Okay.
And so an eigenstate is just a characteristic state of the differential equations that govern whatever it is you're looking at, or the matrix equations of whatever it is you're looking at.
Right. These terms sound really heady, like eigenstate, when it just means characteristic state. It would be nice if it was English.
It's just some way of saying that if
it's a simple idea. It's like if you have a rope tied at two points, it only has vibration modes in half wavelength integers.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it means. But if you have a rope or if you have a guitar string, right, and you pluck your guitar string, you have multiple harmonics going on at the same time.
Yeah.
Each one of those harmonics is an eigenstate of the system, mm-hmm. and the mixed state is what you actually hear, which is more sonorous. Sonorous or sonorous?
Sonorous, I guess.
Sonorous. It's more sonorous. It's much nicer to hear a guitar string than a computer trying to be a guitar string, or at least an Apple II trying to be a guitar string. Right. My computer now, it's perfectly good at being a guitar.
It's harmonizing with itself.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah, you can do good synthesizer stuff on computers these days, personal computers these days, but not with your Apple II speaker.
Yeah.
So, anyways, that's another thing you have to worry about for your interpretations is to what extent is indeterminism different than the indeterminacy, right? Are they together or are they separate? How do they, are they coupled? Are they decoupled? Stuff like that.
Okay.
What was the next one?
Inseparability.
So quantum mechanics is not divisible, is what I have written. Entangled states cannot be analyzed through their individual parts. Okay, I remember that. So, this is something that you get into with Bell's theorem and entangled states and things like that, right?
But is it more general that really any particles that are interacting are part of a larger system, and they have to be considered as subsystems of that state?
Yeah, there's something along those lines.
And that comes in later because, really, it seems like there's an inescapable fact that the whole state of the universe is going to have some interaction with everything else in the universe, including your experiment, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so some theories, I think, try to look at the universal state function.
Mm-hmm.
And try to see how that interacts with your experiment. So there's an unknowability there too. That, you know, how do you know the state vector of the entire universe?
Yeah, exactly. And that's something that we have to ask about each and every interpretation: is how holistic is it? Right.
Yeah.
That's the question I have for this: is how holistic is every interpretation? How connected is everything in the universe? And, I mean, it seems a little bit silly to have everything connected, but it also seems completely necessary, right?
Right. I mean, we're interacting right now with galaxies 15 billion light years away, almost. You know, their radiation is falling on us right now.
But it's 15 billion year old radiation, so we don't have to worry too much about it.
But it still has an effect, right?
I have no idea how much of an effect that has.
I figured cosmic microwave background radiation bathing any subatomic particle is going to give a little jitter, isn't it?
I guess so.
Yeah. And then there's the projection postulate, and this is probably the most well-known weirdness going on in quantum mechanics that people talk about, is the idea that there is that the indeterminate state collapses. This is the collapse of the wave function concept, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where you get a definite value out of something which didn't have a definite value before. The quantum mechanics seems to interpret the measurements as the creation of a state where you can get a definite value, whereas before it was in a superposition of all of these states, right?
Yeah, and we can look at this in terms of that Stern-Gerlach experiment again, right?
Right.
So, you know, you had that beam coming through that we'd prepared to all be in the Z direction, but it was completely agnostic about what's going on in the X or the Y direction.
Right. Right.
But as soon as you put it in that X field, it decides it's going to be in one of those two directions, right?
Yeah.
And then forget about everything else. But it's decided to be in one of those states that it didn't actually have before. And we really get to the idea that it didn't have one of those states before when we get to that third field, right? Or at least according to the state vector formulation, there's no reason to say it's in any of these other states. And it turns out that it turns out that in some way things are randomized, and we don't know what that is. But it seems that the wave function no longer has any information about the Z direction up until the point that you measure it again.
That is baffling. It's so non-classical. It's so counterintuitive. All right, so let's look at some of our... This is my favorite stuff. I love looking at the art of quantum mechanics. What's that?
Well, before we get into that, I would like to talk just a little bit about the difference between this and what Chapter 9 is going to be about in the... Quantum Paradoxes book. So the Quantum Paradoxes book, Chapter 9, is also about the interpretations of quantum mechanics.
Oh.
And he's going to talk about that in terms of the Schrödinger's cat paradox and things like that. Now, Sudbury, and is it Sudbury or Sudsbury?
Sudbury. Yeah.
Thinks that the interpretations are answering the question, what is a state vector?
Right.
Aharonov is going to ask, what does the projection postulate mean?
Okay.
So those are obviously related in some way, but they're not the same question. So
right.
When we're thinking about these things, we want to look at it in both ways, both the way that Sudbury is looking at it, because that's who we're talking about right now, and about what's going on with that projection postulate. Because that's what we're talking about in the podcast, in the main podcast.
Okay. Well, I haven't read that chapter yet, so you're going to have to help. Sorry, I didn't realize we were going to get into that.
Yeah, all we have to look at here is the projection postulate. We don't have to worry about Chapter 9 at this point.
Okay.
Part of the reason why we're reading this now, well, part of the reason is because we've had a little bit of a hiatus because of, you know, work and things. But another reason why we're doing this is to prepare us for that Chapter 9 with all of those interpretations, which he has a different selection and he has a different way of talking about them and so forth and so on. And I had intended to get this into your hands last year before we went on hiatus, because I thought it would be good to talk about this before we got to Chapter 9 anyway. So this wasn't just a random thing by me. This has been something I've been thinking about.
Okay.
And I just hadn't gotten to it, or I made the photocopies and I'd forgotten them somewhere or something like that. I mean, it's not like either of us is not busy enough, right?
Yeah, life in New Orleans can be as chaotic as it can be wonderful.
Okay, so given that, now we can get into the good stuff.
Okay.
And we're going to start with the minimal interpretation.
And this is the one, there was a pre-note to this, before he gets into the list, where he mentioned that the Copenhagen interpretation, which is what you always hear people say, that's the orthodox kind of position. I didn't realize this, but he said that it's been applied to at least four different interpretations.
Well, yeah. So, and his interpretations are classes of interpretations. But I think people who want to tell you that what they're doing is the right way to do it,
yeah,
want to say it's the Copenhagen interpretation.
Right.
Right. And I think, to some extent, physicists don't have the same sort of philosophical mind that mathematicians do, right? Especially if you're talking about sort of English philosophy, which is very mathematical or very logical, right?
Mm-hmm.
I guess they call it analytic philosophy.
Okay.
Right. So those two idea or those two fields, mathematics the way we do mathematics today as opposed to mathematics as they did it in the time of Laplace, right, and analytic philosophy, they developed approximately simultaneously. So George Boole, or Georg Boole, is it George or Georg? I don't know. Well, Boole...
Boolean operators, all yeah. that kind of stuff.
So Boole wrote his Laws of Thought
wow.
in the second half of the 19th century.
Did he write them mathematically?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, so that's the whole reason you have Boolean logic, is it all came from Boole's work. And he worked that out, and then there was some stuff on the foundations of arithmetic, and... Then there was the Principia Mathematica with Russell and Whitehead, and then there was a good 50 years of a very strong analytical tradition in philosophy in England, and to a lesser extent in the United States, where you also had pragmatism being very very strong. So I think that the mathematicians are more in line with the philosophical way of doing things than physicists are, who I think physicists tend to be much more practical, right? In the end, they're talking about the real world. They're talking about something that turns into an experiment. And if, you know, and if they want to sit around and argue about, you know, how many quarks you can fit on the head of a pin, that's fine and dandy, but you can't count quarks, so you're out of luck.
Right. And that, I think that the first interpretation of quantum mechanics is right there. This is the one that was suggested by Bohr.
Mm-hmm.
It's the minimal interpretation, and he talks about the fact that the only thing that matters is that the math is going to predict the experimental results.
Yeah.
And he really didn't want to mess around with the philosophical ramifications of, well, what does it mean that the state vector is undefined until you make a measurement? He was like, it doesn't matter. He's like, just do the math. You'll get the right results, you know, over probabilistic outcomes. And let's see, I think he also somehow, yeah, by saying that the state vector isn't an objective and intrinsic component of the system, that it's just a mathematical device, he just slipped right by the idea of the projection postulate being relevant, because there is no state vector to really explain. To him, it was just a mathematical tool.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a certain clarity of thought, although it's pretty abstract ultimately, which skates by some of the more troubling issues with quantum mechanics. But that's kind of its weakness too, is it doesn't give you any insight.
Well, yeah, and I think the example that Sudbury put in that was very meaningful was that if you really take this minimal interpretation seriously, just because there's a track in a bubble chamber,
mm-hmm.
that would only exist if there's a charged particle in the bubble chamber, doesn't mean there's really a particle there, right? Because all you really care about is how well you're making these predictions. Doesn't say anything about the reality of the particle.
So I think Bohr would look at that track and say, that's not a track of a particle moving through a cloud. That's a series of events triggered by this propagating wave function that we can't imagine because it's this abstraction.
Well, at least according to Sudbury.
Okay.
Yeah. And in that, he was very much in tune with the positivist philosophers, right? So I think Heisenberg it was. I'm not completely sure who it was, but I think Bohr and Heisenberg right. and so on, they were in touch with the people of the Vienna Circle, right? They were all in about the same geographic location. They were all in touch with each other. They all had some interaction, and they actually talked with the positivist philosophers, and I think they were all on the same page.
We should define that because we skipped over those isms at the beginning of the chapter.
Well, I mean, really all we have to know about the positivist philosophers is that there was a group of people in Vienna,
mm-hmm.
and it spread out. And they had certain rules about meaning, right? And the big idea was verificationism.
Right? Right.
The meaning of something is only in how it's verified. And you can see that very strongly in the way that Bohr interprets this, right?
Mm-hmm.
You verify something by doing the experiment, right? Mm-hmm. So the mathematics only means, okay, if
as
I prepare a state this way,
yeah.
right? And then I measure it over here, how well does it predict what I measure over here, right? There is no meaning in the mathematics, which is very strange. It's especially strange coming from Bohr.
Right, somebody that came up with such a clear model of the atom.
Yeah, so his interpretation of the atom, right, his original model of the atom was blatantly a...
classical model.
A blatant classical model, but it was blatantly a model that was putting meaning to these transition probabilities that they didn't have, right? And then using it very well to make more predictions. So it's not just that the Bohr model of the atom was a vision or an interpretation of early quantum transition or early quantum mechanical facts. It was a very fruitful model that was very useful both for teaching people about what was going on or giving people some idea about what was going on mm-hmm. with atomic theory. It also led to a lot of discoveries and quantum mechanics, right?
Yeah.
So it's like Bohr turned, you know, 180 degrees after he got really big into... At some point, it's like he turned 180 degrees, although philosophically he may not have done that. It may have just, to him, been some sort of analogy, right? But the what he did and how people used it is 180 degrees from this minimal interpretation, right? Because if you have this minimal interpretation, you're not really thinking about the physics anymore, right? You're thinking about the math.
Yeah, there's nothing to visualize.
Yeah. And that's not good. People use analogies very, very well, much better than they use mathematics.
Yeah, that's where the rest of the art of physics comes in that I love so much, is finding models that you can grasp with your visual cognitive abilities and being able to go, okay, if that's how this works, then what does that mean? And can I devise new experiments and get new kinds of results?
Yeah, and that's actually the second problem that I have written down here for the minimal interpretation. And that was, I mean, the whole purpose of a theory is to understand the world, right? It's
right.
Not just to calculate it, the result of an experiment. That's the purpose of maybe an engineering rule, right?
Right.
You have a nice simple rule that you can use over and over and over again, and you know that your bridge isn't going to collapse.
Right.
But for a physicist, what they really want to do is understand the meaning of the world better than the last person, right? Or they want to understand things better next week than they did last week. And that's what they're doing this week.
Yeah, Sudbury, I think, had some kind of a blurb in there, and he asked the question, why on earth would anybody just want to predict the results of experiments? You know, what good is that?
That's right. Okay.
All right, so let's see. I guess that, yeah, those are the main objectives. And if there's also, or objections, I mean, there's another objection to the minimal interpretation in that it's so subjective, that it falls a lot into the solipsistic category where, you know, Bohr's basically falling into the camp of, there isn't a tree there that I'm looking at. There is just my experience of visual stimulation on my eyeball that my brain is interpreting as a tree. So it doesn't have any ontological status without my perception of it. Which is a lot like the tedious argument that there's no sound if you don't, there's in a forest if a tree falls and nobody hears it.
I mean, that's usually considered a failing in a philosophical theory. Probably ought to be considered a failing in an interpretation of a physical theory as well.
Yeah.
I don't really think that this gets to that point, but yeah, I mean, it is on that road, right? It's on the road to solipsism. But none of these, I think, gets there, really.
Well, I don't know. He's saying that particle doesn't have an independent existence until it's measured.
Well, that's another problem with all of these interpretations, is because you don't really know what a measurement is. I think he may have talked marginally about that when talking about the projection postulate, but what is a measurement is another question that needs answering that doesn't have a good answer. Right. And
that's where a lot of the quantum mysticism is coming in, because people are confusing measurement with observation.
Yeah. And that's probably von Neumann's fault, but that's okay. When he decided to call things observables, and now all of a sudden it becomes the observer's important. Right. And so we can live with that. I mean, people make all sorts of errors when they're, when they're interpreting mathematical language as if it was English, right?
So well, there are a couple interpretations in here, though, where that is the observer is concluded in part of the philosophy, right?
I think that is true, but I think that's an issue.
Yeah, that's all of these. That's one of the fun things about this section, is that he shows the objections to every interpretation, and each interpretation has some very valid objections.
Yeah.
Like, not, you can't really glom on to any one of them without having an unease about a fundamental flaw.
Okay, so would you like to move on to the literal interpretation?
Yeah.
Okay, so in that case, the state vector is a property of the system, kind of like position and momentum are.
Right.
So it's not just the position and the momentum that are properties of the system, so is the state vector. And this is a very literal way of, there it is, literal. A very literal way of interpreting the mathematics is you just say the mathematics says this, so that's what it is.
Yeah.
Right. So again, you have your projection postulate. Well, that's a real change in the system. And that's basically it, right? State vectors can't be decoupled because there's only one real state vector, and that's the universe's state vector.
Right, and the problems of indeterminism and indeterminacy and inseparability are all just things that we have to live with in this model.
Yeah,
like, just yeah, that's the way it is. Eat it.
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay, so the objections to that model?
Well, I think the first one is you can't ever figure out what... So if you're doing an experiment, right, you need to prepare the system, which means you have to know what the state vector is at the beginning.
Okay.
And then you measure the system. But if you're stuck with the state vector of the entire universe, right, in some way, mm-hmm. you can never really establish that state vector. In fact, you can't ever really establish what the state vector is. You don't measure the state vector, right? You measure the position. You measure the z component of the spin.
Which are all just components of the state vector.
That's right. And so you never get a complete state vector to put in any of your measurements or any of your preparation schemes.
Right. So how can you say that the state vector has an objective reality mm-hmm. if any measurement that you derive from it is going to have a truth across a whole range of other values.
Like yeah.
If you measure one value, then there can be a whole other range of values that you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't ever pin it down. Yeah. That's an interesting problem. And of course it's got all of the other problems that were brought up before is mm-hmm. there's the problems with the projection postulate.
Mm-hmm.
What is a measurement? How does it work? There's the problems of indeterminacy and indeterminism and inseparability. Like, it doesn't resolve any of that. It doesn't even attempt to resolve any of that. It just says, yeah, that's the way it is.
And the next interpretation is pretty much the same thing. It's called, he calls it the objective interpretation, which is very similar to the literal interpretation, except the state vector can be restricted to some subspace, to some subsystem, rather than the entire system.
And when he says, he's saying the state vector is restricted to certain subspaces, he's meaning within an infinite Hilbert space, or whatever the Hilbert space pertains to the values that you're measuring?
Something like that. I don't think you need it. I don't think you're talking necessarily about an infinite Hilbert space. I think that shows up somewhere in quantum field theory or in string theory or something like that.
Okay.
But
subspaces, he just means within sort of an abstract mathematical edifice, not like some kind of Star Trekian subspace.
Yeah, when he's talking about subspace, he's talking about some sort of, it would be a Hilbert space that you're looking at, where you have this state, you have basically all your possible states, and there's a way to measure the likelihood of going from one to the other, right? That's the Hilbert space, and that's the space. This says in the objective interpretation that you're able to circumscribe some of those subspaces so that you can make measurements on those and not have to worry about the rest of the wave function.
But there's also the factor that the objective interpretation brings in, where it says that there can be a constant jumping between any of these different vectors, I believe, which are probabilistically determined by the Schrodinger equation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like it's giving a reality to the probability distribution. It's saying that it's not one value that we have to determine
mm-hmm.
By measuring it, but rather that this state vector is moving constantly through in time between these different subspaces.
Yeah.
Or within that subspace along different vectors, right?
I think it has something to do with that. It has some sort of a well-defined trajectory, this probability, or it has a well-defined probability.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's actually supposed to be the good part about it, that it makes it better than, in some ways, the literal interpretation.
Right, because it's a physical idea of, well, we can't determine that specific vector until we measure it, because it's always in movement between mm-hmm. them. I like that model.
I think the strange thing here that I don't really follow completely was apparently you need at least two wave functions, and at least one of those is unmeasurable.
Oh.
This was one of his objections to the objective interpretation.
That's right. The whole state in each possible state are properties of the system. And so since we can't know all of the different properties of the state, then there's sort of a loss of objectivity to the reality of one specific state at any given moment, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. And I'm seeing here, the state vector describes the entire universe, and instantaneous transitions seem to violate special relativity, because if your system is coupled to the whole universe and you take a measurement, it would seem to alter the state vector of the entire universe simultaneously. In simultaneity, it's supposed to be relative in special relativity.
Mm-hmm. And I think there was something here that it seems...
But I don't know is that a valid objection, because entanglement already shows us that there is a violation of special relativity, doesn't it?
Well, that's the claim, right? But it may be that... I'm not completely sure that it does show us there's a violation of special relativity, although I think that in a lot of the interpretations, it must violate special relativity. And that was obviously the problem that Einstein always had, right?
Yeah.
And we've already been talking about that over and over, and we get to talk about that for many, many more months. But yeah, the main issue there is that in a lot of these interpretations, there has to be some transfer of information. But that's a function of the interpretation. That's not a function of the actual mathematics, right? The mathematics doesn't say anything about, again, what's happened, and that's why this isn't a problem with the minimal interpretation, right? The mathematics doesn't say anything about communication between these two things, so they don't necessarily communicate. There's just the mathematics just says there's something about a correlation. When you set up the aspect experiment, you're going to get some sort of correlation.
Okay.
That's all the mathematics says. Now, you can decide that means something about transfer of information from one side of the universe to the other. That's fine. But don't put it on the mathematics, man.
Well, I think the main way that interpretations skate around special relativity is the idea that quantum entanglement doesn't actually transfer information from one point to the other faster than the speed of light, because mm-hmm. that's not usable information of any kind,
because mm-hmm.
you don't know what the state of the other particle is until you're told, and that has to be transmitted through some conventional means, which is restricted to the speed of light.
Yeah.
But where it gets hinky is some kind of change appears to be apparent instantaneously between two points.
Mm-hmm.
And even if that doesn't transfer any useful information, it does seem like you're acting through a distance faster than the speed of light by changing the state of something there, here, when you take a measurement. But I don't know if we can actually determine if that's true. Is that true? Can we actually tell from particle B, a light year away, that particle A has been measured?
I don't think so. I think you can just do the measurement, right? But you can't really tell that it's been measured.
Until you compare your notes on either side? Oh, okay. Sneaky.
So, but I mean, still, if you can compare your notes on either side, that means that some...
In retrospect, you can see that action happened at a distance.
that's right. So maybe you can't communicate, but maybe you can't communicate, but in a lot of these interpretations, you would say that the two particles communicated, right? Or something in that wave function, something in that entangled wave function communicated when this measurement happened. So it might still be one wave function, but it's a really long extended wave function with a big, nearly zero spot in the middle.
Right.
So, so in that case, you you don't really get out of the special relativity thing that way, right? Because you still have that same problem sitting there, is how do these two things know, right?
Yeah.
Although you go into the minimal interpretation, it says that's not the theory's problem. So just stop thinking about it. But, you know, if you're trying to think about what this stuff means, you have to worry about that, because there has to be something going on, something non-local some way.
Right.
Right. And when we get into Aharonov, he's going to eventually say that everything's local in space, but this process is non-local in time, right? Which is going to be even weirder. Right?
But then, doesn't Bell's inequality show that there is no local interpretation of quantum mechanics?
That's one way to put it together. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going off the top of my head. I think there are two or three things. I think probably two. There are two things that you want in your physical theory. Maybe three. And Bell's theorem shows that at least one of those can't be true.
And I think hidden variables was one of the alternatives to get out of that.
Yeah.
But hidden variables have been.
Yeah, so
beaten
you
down so far.
So you try to do the hidden variables, but then you get stuck with how do you have hidden variables with entanglement, with a non-local
effect.
And so now you're
back where you started.
Yeah. So again, none of these things is satisfactory.
Right.
And you just at some point you have to live with something, at least overnight. Right.
Okay.
So if you have an objective interpretation, right, then you have to have a subjective interpretation.
Oh, is that where we're going next?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, the epistemic. The epistemic?
Epistemic.
Epistemic, the subjective interpretation. Okay.
Okay. And in this case, the state vector represents your knowledge of the system. It doesn't represent anything about the system. Your knowledge of the system, which
that's about as metaphysical as it gets.
Well, it is, but this is again the objective and the subjective interpretations are, I think, very similar to the objective and subjective interpretations of probability. So in these cases, in both of these cases, I said earlier that you want to think about, are these interpretations of the probability or of the physics?
Right.
These are interpretations of the probability. These are interpretations of the mathematics,
okay,
mostly. And the subjective interpretation has been very useful in decision theory.
Really?
Yes, and that's what they use. In decision theory, they'd have, when they talk about Bayesian statistics is a subjective interpretation of probability.
Huh, I didn't know that.
And it's been very useful, I don't think it's true for all cases that this Bayesian idea works, but it certainly is useful for some models of learning and things like that. So it's a useful idea. It doesn't necessarily mean it's the right thing for interpreting quantum theory.
Yeah, it's weird to apply that. I mean, to make literally the state of your knowledge to be part of the equation.
Well, it's not just part of the equation. In the end, the state of your knowledge is the state vector, right? The state vector is the state of your knowledge. It doesn't have anything to do with the world, which is the weird thing.
So the indeterminacy of the values of these observables is simply a reflection of your lack of knowledge of them.
Yeah. And that's one of the main objections, right? Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, the measured states, when you measure a state, it can reflect a real event, right? Radioactive decay is a real event.
Right.
It has physical consequences at the macro scale.
Right.
So you can't say that that's just a change in your knowledge of the system. It's an actual change in the system, right?
Right.
Something has to happen, right, to turn uranium into lead. It's not just, you know, you were looking at it and all of a sudden it turned into lead, right?
Yeah, there is that weird. I said there's something about the Schrodinger's cat equation though, that makes it look like the cat could possibly be in an indeterminate state until you look.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that would be the epistemic interpretation of Schrodinger's cat.
In some paradox. Way, yeah. Yeah, I think it goes on. We're going to look at that in detail next time, we'll look at that in detail with fewer interpretations next time we get together. But I think, there is a strong epistemic quality to that problem when people are talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is going to be one, yeah, so there's a strong epistemic quality to that argument that maybe the cat's alive, maybe it's dead. But in the end, the purpose of the Schrodinger's cat equation is to focus on that and show, hey, this is a problem with interpreting quantum mechanics. That's the reason why Schrodinger invented a cat.
Right, to show you how ludicrous it was to say that the cat was in an indeterminate state until you looked.
Yeah. So that's the purpose of Schrodinger's cat, is to showcase this problem that is, and I'm going to guess that this subjective interpretation is one of the four that has been called the Copenhagen interpretation at one point or another.
Really?
That's going to be my guess. Because he doesn't actually say which one's happening.
Yeah, I was really disappointed he didn't point them out.
Yeah, so that's another thing about reading from a mathematician, is that they don't want to use any extra words.
Well, unfortunately, this is also the interpretation which has gotten so mystified and popularized. The idea, and this is the idea that your consciousness is part of the experiment.
I first heard about that from an 18-year-old girl. So.
After she saw What the Bleep Do We Know? After she saw What the Bleep Do We Know?
No, she was an artist that decided to study physics and then decided to stop studying physics after she got into the quantum mechanics stuff and saw what the math was like. But
it is hairy.
Yeah. But you know, she did really like that interpretation. I never liked that interpretation.
No, me either. Because if you have a machine that's taking the measurements, and you know, when you're not even there and aware of the experiment being done, all of the mathematics still plays out without you even looking at it, right?
Yeah. Well, I think she was listening to read the Tao of Physics or something like that, and you know, those guys got into ideas like, maybe that wasn't the right one, but you know, the guys who were writing, at least in the 1970s and 80s, about this stuff would say things like, well, you know, that table has a consciousness, man. I shouldn't say it that way, but I probably should, because they did like certain substances.
Well, the Buddhists have been saying for thousands of years that Bodhi mind is everything, everywhere, and
yeah.
Everything.
Well, maybe it was the Dancing Woodley Masters then. But yeah, they have that idea that there is a consciousness in the table. So the table is observing the light from your lamp, and that's enough consciousness to do this.
That doesn't seem very satisfactory either.
Because
if the universe was always observing, then no quantum state would ever be in an indeterminate state, right? Because it would always be under observation.
There you go. And I guess if God was looking at you all the time, then the universe wouldn't evolve either.
So you'd have to make a distinguishment. You'd have to distinguish between the table and the experimental apparatus. You'd have to endow the machine that's running the experiment without you in the room with some quality of consciousness to collapse the wave function, right?
Yeah.
That doesn't seem very satisfactory either.
Okay. Then he got into Einstein's interpretation.
The ensemble interpretation.
Yeah, well, he attributed this to Einstein. I don't know that Einstein would agree, but this is what he attributed to Einstein. This is a pretty common one too, I think. So it's really a statistical interpretation. You say, okay, you know, we run a bunch of experiments, then this is going to happen. This might be a certain kind of interpretation of probability, though.
Yeah.
So
it's a compelling argument, though.
Yeah, I think it's a frequent. Well, it is. I mean, yeah. You say, okay, I do all this math, and it tells me something about what happens when I get a probability. So that means it has something to do with what happens when I run 1,000 experiments, right?
Right.
And that would be very similar to what would happen if I was to do an analysis of a card deck or rolling dice or something like that.
Right.
So this is similar to what I call a frequentistic interpretation of probability.
Right.
And it has, of course, the same problem, which is that in the end, you don't have an infinite number of experiments to run, but the actual mathematics doesn't have it. The mathematics would tell you that you could run it. You should be able to run it. The mathematics would say that to actually verify the statement, right?
Right. You have to run an infinite number of experiments to create the perfect probability function that you see.
That's right.
I don't know if that's is that a kind of a bitchy argument against this. I mean,
I'd say so. Yeah, I've never been really convinced with that, even in the idea of probability. Right, I've never been convinced of that as a strong interpretation. I've always thought it was fairly or a strong objection. I've always thought it was fairly weak to say, okay, yeah, if you flip a coin 10,000 times, you can find out that it has a probability of 51% to 49%, but that doesn't really mean that you found out anything more about this coin, right? In fact, I think you do find out something about that coin. It's not just something about your knowledge of the coin. It's about, you know, the coin and its balance and the way you flip the coin and all that other stuff. Right. So I think that's not a really good objection. But there are a whole lot of people who think that's a great objection. Right? I mean, it is a common objection, and it's part of the reason why you have subjective interpretations of probability, is because a lot of people can't sign on to that interpretation.
But all of our entire edifice of physics is founded on a limited number of experiments that we extrapolate to more general mathematics over an infinite range. So why should we pick this one out and say, oh no, we can't use this to explain this?
Well, I think the problem is that in the end, this requires the in the end, if you look at it in detail, this interpretation is going to require that the probability be a limit of an infinite number of experiments.
Yeah, but that's fine, because
but you're never going to have an infinite number of experiments, so
right.
It can't be a limit of that, because that doesn't exist. Again, I don't find that convincing, but people do find that convincing.
Is there a stronger argument against it?
Well,
it doesn't resolve the issues with the projection postulate.
Well, it doesn't. It does not resolve those problems. The ensemble doesn't have a physical or a theoretical reality. The ensemble is actually kind of vague, right? You just say, okay, I run the experiment a whole bunch of times. So I don't think it has as many objections as everything else, but I think the big one was that it doesn't resolve any problem at all with the projection postulate.
Right. And that is kind of sticky.
Then we get to everybody's favorite, which is the many worlds interpretation.
Yes, many people love this one, but, you know, I just can't. It just seems like a long distance to go. The idea is that, I guess, for every possible outcome, there's a universe that branches off from that outcome?
Yeah, in the way that he's talking about it, it's a branching universe, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know that that's the only way to talk about many worlds interpretations, but this the way he's talking about it is a branching universe. Every time that there's a decision, every time there's an observation, every time there's an experiment,
or an event, right? Because aren't any interactions in the universe ultimately boil down to a range of probabilities?
Yeah.
And so for every one of those possible outcomes, mm-hmm. which is like infinities upon infinities upon infinities happening in the universe right now, there'd have to be new universes for every one of those outcomes?
Yeah.
My God.
So
makes the Big Bang look like a firecracker. Come on.
Yeah, so in this case, it's, yeah, well, I guess you and I don't buy it. It's very hard to figure out what's going on. You know, you're part of the system, right? So it's very difficult to look at this and take it seriously for me, right? And, you know, it just doesn't seem to be meaningful to me.
Not practical either, because it doesn't help you resolve why you're in this universe.
Well, yeah, it doesn't tell you why you're in this universe rather than that one. It doesn't tell you anything about the universe, right? It doesn't help you come up with a new experiment. It doesn't do anything like that. The only reason why it's really popular now is because people, well, I shouldn't say that. But anyways, yeah, it doesn't really help you in any given way, right? So I don't think it's going to be I don't think it's a really great way to look at these things. We'll talk more about this in the podcast, because this is one of the ones that Aharonov is going to explicitly compare to. He's going to explicitly compare and contrast to the other three through the Schrodinger cat paradox.
Oh, great.
So we'll get to see this one again.
In chapter 9 of the Quantum Paradoxes podcast?
That's right.
Okay.
Let's see. Then there's the quantum logical interpretation.
This one's kind of fascinating. I'd never heard of this one before.
Okay. Well, that's because not a lot of people use quantum logic. Quantum logic is a trivalent logic that was invented by von Neumann. And the whole idea is that, you know, you have true, false, and indeterminate, three different truth values to any proposition or to any experiment.
Okay.
And that, when you do this, then you can say that you have a definite value for all of your observables, although that value could be indeterminate, right?
Right.
But that's one of the values in your logic.
So that's an expansion of the logic that we're familiar with, the classical logic, which would only have yes and no, true and false.
Yeah, basically. And there are lots of different multivalent logics. The multivalent logics are a branch of philosophy that people play around with. And the biggest problem with this is that you have some really weird ideas, like normally you say if Q or V is true, that means either Q is true or V is true, right?
Right.
If one of these two things is true, or if the disjunction of these things is the case, is then at least one of those two things has to actually be true, mm-hmm. right? But that's not true in this when you go through this quantum logic stuff. So quantum logic was a very interesting mathematical thing. It's not really that interesting as a interpretation of quantum mechanics.
If it had greater utility outside of quantum theory, then I would find it, you know, really a fertile ground to explore. But apparently, one of the objections is that it's very selective,
mm-hmm.
and it just picks out the distributive law and changes that and nothing else. And that if it was really going to be a compelling interpretation, that it should offer, I guess, an entirely new kind, a new mathematics to apply to everything.
It has problems like that. You really need to get everything stuck back down to zero. You really have to find a way to start from this quantum probability.
And end up with classical logic.
Yeah, quantum logic and end up... you have to start with quantum logic and do everything. Quantum logic actually requires classical logic to build.
Right.
And so it's kind of a little bit strange to say the fundamental logic is something I need to create from the not fundamental logic. But to actually build it up mathematically, you have to start with bivalent logic.
Well, if you could go the other way, then you might have an interesting case, though. If you could start with quantum logic and then derive the how it reduces to classical logic in a macroscopic system, then you know, it'd be pretty interesting stuff, right?
Yeah, it wouldn't be a macroscopic system. I'm not sure if anybody's done it with quantum logic, but I think probably people have done it with other trivalent logics. So that's something to look into, but it's not that strong, right? Because you know basically you're looking at a way to hide the problem in a lot of ways. I shouldn't say that, but it looks that way. It looks like you're hiding the problem in your vocabulary rather than trying to confront the problem head on, which is fine as long as you're looking at things in that minimalist idea. But if you're really trying to understand what's going on, I don't think it really helps, right? Because you know, you're saying, well, maybe it's indeterminate,
anything, huh?
Right? But then, well, we kind of already knew that. We want to know why when I take this Stern-Gerlach experiment and I measure the X direction, all of a sudden I don't know anything about the Z direction anymore, right?
Yeah.
I want to know why that is. I don't want to just say that it is. Right. And by putting all of this into this quantum logical interpretation, you don't help me out. You don't even help me out by saying, well, this is fundamental. Well, I know this is fundamental at some level already, right? Mm. But I'd like to understand it better than just knowing that this is the case and understanding that it comes from, certain aspects of conjugate variables and things like that, that certain measurements are intertwined. I understand that at a mathematical level, and I don't need another level of mathematics to help me understand it at a mathematical, at a physical level, because it's still just more mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
At least to me, more mathematics is more mathematics. It doesn't explain things where the problem is interpreting the mathematics.
Ah, right. Yeah, it's not really a physics answer, huh?
Yeah. Okay, then we have hidden variables. Lots of them. Mention your favorite. Mention Bohm's. Hidden variables are sort of the favorite thing for people, right? There are billions and billions of possible hidden variable theories, and when people investigate them and they get rid of hidden variable theories, they actually try to get rid of whole classes of hidden variable theories at a time.
Right.
They don't bother with investigating, well, what if I do this, this, and this? They tend to look at, okay, how much can I generalize? They look at somebody's idea, then they say, how much can I generalize that and still find a way to show that it's not viable?
Well, there are some good objections to it, and I'm a little bit less enamored of the de Broglie-Bohm model after reading them. One of the objections that I found really convincing here is that the distribution of particle positions would seem to be pretty implausible if they really are separate particles.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's, if you look at that as like a photon going through a diffraction grating,
mm-hmm.
that somehow it's going to be able to traverse at any of these crazy angles as it's moving towards the apparatus to go through one of the grates at some great length,
mm-hmm.
Why would it go that far off, right? If you're trying to shoot it straight ahead, why would it suddenly head out almost at some oblique angle and mm-hmm. go in the grating at some other spot? Yeah, that's a good question. And there was also an objection here. It says that it violates special relativity via action at instantaneous action at distance.
Yeah, and we'll read more about that again with Aharonov stuff.
Okay.
And that's part of the reason why he's talking about these why he's talking. He's going to talk about things being non-local in time. But in the end, yeah, you're stuck with the same problem, which is whatever's happened way over there has to somehow be connected to whatever happens over there. And when you have a hidden variable theory, a lot of times, maybe not in all of them, but in most of them, now you're talking about having a position or something over here that has to somehow communicate way over there where that position is, because it's wandering around. You know, you've got a pilot wave that the particle's playing around in, right? Mm-hmm. Well, that pilot wave has to be connected to that other pilot wave, you know, on the other side of the laboratory, or on the other side of the building, or wherever it is you're doing, however it is you're doing this, right? So that pilot wave has to have those same properties as any quantum mechanical system has, right? You still have to have whatever's happening to this pilot wave happen to that pilot wave, so it can affect the particle, so you can measure it.
And that has to happen instantaneously.
And that has to happen instantaneously, at least. That has to happen instantaneously.
So basically, the pilot waves can't have an independent existence. They all have to be part of this larger system.
And they have to propagate when disturbed instantaneously. But that's not completely true, and we'll find out why when we read the Aharonov stuff.
Interesting. Okay.
Probably in chapter 17.
Here's another one of my favorite interpretations. The last one, number 9, is the stochastic interpretation.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. It still has this non-locality problem, but it is really fun in that you're saying, okay, what's happening is your particles just getting bounced around, jiggled around by everything in the universe.
Yeah.
Right. Which, in a way, it does. Right. I mean, that's what happens to things.
Yeah, you can't isolate anything.
Yeah. So, I mean, we like to talk about it, but there are things going on, and an elementary particle is even a buckyball or something like that. It's really small, so small changes here or there could end up magnifying into large changes on a screen after it's gone through a double slit experiment or something like that, right? Mm. So, I mean, there's something to that. But in the end, probably not that much. Well, I mean, it is interesting. It's the same idea as having Brownian motion, right? Mm-hmm. But you have Brownian motion at this elementary particle level rather than at the, you know, little speck of pollen level.
Well, that's a nice intuitive model. And the objections to this model... I didn't really understand the two objections, frankly, to this model, but I didn't see the one that I expected, which was I thought that the stochastic interpretation would require a Lorentz invariant field of radiation throughout the entire universe, which there's no explanation for that field, right?
Well,
but he didn't mention that here, which
so. One, what he's calling a stochastic interpretation might not be what you're talking about. And two, he's, again, looking at categories. Mm. So you might have a specific kind of stochastic interpretation of quantum mechanics in mind.
Yeah, well, the only one that I was aware that actually had produced papers and had been able to replicate physical equations of quantum mechanics was the stochastic electrodynamics of Trevor Marshall's work and some of the other authors in that subject, where they were able to derive things like the Casimir effect and a whole host of quantum mechanical mathematics.
Well, I think that's later than this book.
It's later where?
Do you know when that happened? Do you know when that was formulated?
Oh, I guess it's fairly recent. I think 20 years.
So that's all much later than this book.
Oh, this book was... that's right. This book was written in 1986.
Yeah, so I think that... Yeah, so... So you can think about where that would actually be categorized in his categorization scheme, right? It might not be categorized as a stochastic interpretation in his... Because you've got this other stuff that you have to keep track of, right? You just said you had to have that Lorentz something.
The Lorentz invariant field of energy basically would have to permeate the universe in order for them to replicate the math of quantum mechanics.
So that might also be considered a hidden variables interpretation.
Oh, right, because the whole universe would have this property, right?
Yeah, that you can't measure, but is somehow affecting the particles. But it could also be this, right? But I'm not sure. There's no reason to say that these are all mutually exclusive, right? In fact, several of these
they bleed into each other, definitely.
Yeah, several of these are points on a continuum, right? The literal and the objective interpretations, for example, are part of a continuum. And I think I saw in my notes that another one of these was also on that continuum. So there's no reason why any new theory has to, or any new interpretation has to be in any particular one of these categories.
Right.
These are the categories as he saw them in 1986. There's no objective truth to these categories beyond, you know, I need some way to talk about how these things differ.
Okay. Right? Yeah.
And maybe somebody can find an interpretation that has nothing to do with these. Maybe somebody can find an interpretation that has to do with three of them, right?
Right.
But in the end, the categorization scheme is just a way to help me try to figure out what's going on with all these crazy interpretations that are going on, because none of them seem to work.
Well,
and you're not going to get one that works until you figure out why none of the other ones do.
Sure. Well, there have been a couple of fascinating experimental advances since the time he wrote this book. I believe that that some of the work on weak measurement was used to verify the diagrammatic representation predicted by the de Broglie-Bohm model.
Well, okay, yeah, we can talk about that again. Like we've probably talked about before, weak measurements are going to be a major thing in the second half of the book. So chapters 10 through 18, all about weak measurements and the interpretation of quantum mechanics. That's what we're going to be talking about.
Okay. And this guy, this author, Trevor Marshall, came up with a prediction shortly after 2000 for spontaneous parametric upconversion, where you get two photons and see if you can combine them together in a nonlinear crystal and end up with one higher energy photon.
Mm-hmm.
And his prediction, the first experiment failed to replicate or failed to create the results he predicted. So the whole field kind of died for a few years. A lot of public interest was lost. And then recently somebody actually succeeded. So he made a prediction based on the stochastic interpretation, which proved to be true. So there are some interesting things happening on these different interpretations that's fun to think about.
Yep. Sounds good. So I'm already 15 minutes late.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Okay. So I think I'm going to have to call my wife, and I think this is about what we can get done with. Do you have any last words?
No. You enjoy your evening, and thanks for your time, Jim.
Bye now.